Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we bring you Nigerian writer Chimamanda Adichie from March 2019. It was the culminating event of Everybody Reads. Each year, the Multnomah County Library chooses one book they hope the whole county will read. Between January and April, the library and their partner organizations host events based around the themes of the book, and they distribute thousands of free copies, thanks to the Library Foundation, to readers of all ages from across the county. Here at Literary Arts, our role is to bring the author to town for a talk at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. This year, the library selected two books by Chimamanda Adichie, the novel Americana, and the book version of her TED Talk, We Should All Be Feminists. Adichie brings to this talk, just as she does to all of her writing, a global perspective. Born in Nigeria, she came to the U.S. when she was 19 and now splits her time between the two countries. Adichie was just 26 when her first book, Purple Hibiscus, was published. At age 30, she won the Orange Prize for the novel Half a Yellow Sun. And by age 31, Adichie was the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Around this time, she also gave a TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story, which is one of the most watched TED Talks of all time. It launched Adichie into a role of international public intellectual, such as very few writers ever become. When she joined us in 2019, she had published six books in all of them bestsellers. She's embraced a public life while also staying an intensely private person. She's a passionate advocate not only for women's rights, but for social justice, and she speaks around the world. She has said, quote, "I see myself as a writer, a storyteller, an artist. Writing is what gives my life meaning. But I am also a citizen. My responsibility as an artist is to my art. My responsibility as a citizen is to the truth and to justice." Here's Adichie.
Thank you. Hello, Portland. I have a bit of a cold, so I'm going to ask you to forgive my croaky voice. It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to be back in Portland. Earlier today, I spoke to just the most interesting, delightful young people at Jefferson High School and Gresham High School. And it was just really, it was such an honor for me, really. And when I first came to the US 30 years ago, good Lord. Yeah, almost. I went to college at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and I had trouble just really making sense of America. Everything was confusing. But one of the things that was a ray of rare light for me was a friendship I formed with a lovely woman, a white woman, whose name was Caroline, and she's here. And we don't get to see each other very often, but every time we do, we just pick up from where we last left off. And so, Missy, I love you. I'm going to talk about my writing and how I became a writer. And afterwards, I'd be very happy to take questions. The reality of being a writer today is that it is no longer sufficient merely to write. You must also participate in the rituals of book promotion. Now, I should say that unlike some of my fellow writers who quite understandably hate any form of public performance, I quite enjoy some of these outings, the operative word being some. I enjoy some interviews and readings and conversations, and I enjoy meeting my readers. But all of these performances and events necessarily involve a certain kind of explaining. The premise is that the writer knows herself, knows her art. But the truth is that my fiction writing process is not always entirely conscious. I do not always know the why. The great joy in writing fiction comes during the magical moments of being transported, of being blissfully lost in one's imaginative space. And those moments are difficult to distill into intellectually coherent explanations. And so I have had to invent answers to the sorts of questions writers are often asked about my process, my choices, my characters. And in inventing those answers, sometimes I believe myself and sometimes I do not. It is in some ways like being your own psychoanalyst, which is not the most pleasant prospect, really. For me, the ideal is to write a piece of fiction and then to talk about anything else but that piece of fiction. And so I will speak today about the touchstones in my life: home, family, church, school. Not because I am certain of how they shaped my writing, but because I know they must have shaped it. I am the daughter of a professor. And for me, to be in a university anywhere in the world today is to feel an immediate sense of familiarity and comfort. I grew up on the campus of the University of Nigeria in Nsukka, a small town in southeastern Nigeria. The campus was spread across undulating grounds, houses on tree-lined streets, red dust, well-tended hedges. It was a slow, small, and lovely place. Its decline would come, starting with military dictatorships that stopped funding education, but my childhood in the early 1980s was the last gasp of the university's sparkling age. At the main entrance of the campus was a large gate with security guards in uniform, complete with berets, many of them elderly men with gentle demeanors, and before each car drove through, the driver stopped, got out of the car and opened the trunk. When, at perhaps the age of about 11 or 12, my father or mother let me come out and open the trunk, it felt like a rite of passage to adulthood, to responsibility. But checking cars as they drove in and out of campus was really a symbol of apartness, of specialness. It said the campus was not part of the larger town, and it was not. It was a world of its own. It had a Catholic church and a Protestant church. It had a children's library. It had a well-staffed medical center. It had a primary school for the children of the staff. It had a swimming pool and tennis court and a hockey pitch and a basketball court. And when the general electricity was cut off, the campus generators came on. In these privileges, I was fortunate to partake. As children, we were seen and we felt seen. And so we grew up with a sureness of self because our world recognized us and acknowledged us. In my family, I was the child who wanted to know the story of who we were. I was the child who found romance in our history, who felt nostalgia for things not yet experienced. I was the child who sharpened very early on the skill of eavesdropping, a pastime at which I am still quite adept. At family gatherings, I felt a part of things and yet also ever so slightly removed from things. I do not know a time when I was not drawn to story, to human emotion and human motivation. This is all I have ever known, this longing, this sense of being always one step removed, one step apart, and watching, always watching. When I was 5, my father was appointed deputy vice chancellor of the university, and he was assigned a new house, number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue. Before my family moved into the house, the previous occupant happened to be, in an odd bit of coincidence that would later gain significance, the acclaimed writer, Professor Chinua Achebe, who was also a staff of the university. I did not think much of this growing up, since university staff moved in and out of university housing, until years later when my first novel was about to be published here in the US. My editor asked me to tell her about my life. I did. And then I added, oh, By the way, I grew up in a house formerly occupied by one of the greatest writers in the world, Chinua Achebe. And she said to me, her eyes wide, "That is the most interesting thing you've told me about yourself." So I then resolved at that moment to make sure that this was always included in my biography as one of my life's great achievements. I remember the house as it was then, a light blue two-story house in a large yard, the green hedge of whistling pine, the gracious graveled driveway, the row of purple bougainvillea bordered by white lilies that shrank and died each Harmattan season, and then magically flowered again when the rains came. The first time we saw the house, we looked at the living room, dining room, guest room, and kitchen downstairs, and then it was time to go upstairs. I began to cry when I saw the stairs. They looked insurmountably high. I stood there and refused to climb. Finally, my big sister Uche held my hand, and we took it one step at a time until we got to the top. But only weeks after we moved in, I was sliding on a pillow down the banister with my brothers, Oke and Kenne. I remember playing football with my brothers and our neighbors, the Ejeres, on the lawn, empty milk cans placed as goalposts. By the way, I mean real football, not American football. I remember playing badminton on the lawn, a rope as our net, so that we argued interminably whether the shuttle had gone over or under. I remember our gardener, whose name was Jomo, watering the plants with a metal watering can, and my brother Oke following him around. And later, Oke told me a story that Jomo had told him. Jomo used to have red eyes, because he had fought in the Nigeria-Biafra War and had killed people, and his eyes had turned red. But after the war, he had gone through a cleansing ritual where he swore that he had not killed any innocent people, and his eyes had lost their redness. My brother must have been about 10, and I about 7, but the story stayed with me and was there in my subconscious as I, many years later, researched and wrote my novel about the Nigeria-Biafra War, Half of a Yellow Sun. I remember the frangipani tree that we climbed and from which I once fell, a fall that left a mark on my arm. And because I am spatially challenged, it is that mark that I now use to tell my left from my right. I remember the guava tree that had an elegant slouch to its branches, and it was on its thickened stem that the white fluffy chickens bought in the market were tied before they were killed for Sunday lunch. I remember riding my bicycle up and down the slope of the street. All the other children loved going downhill, but I hated the loss of control, and so I went, not fast and thrilled as they did, but slowly, carefully cradling the bicycle's brakes. I remember the disgustingly flat, oversized cockroaches that crawled in with the rainy season and smelled utterly horrible. We called them American cockroaches. This is true. They were not the usual smaller Nigerian cockroaches. I am not sure why they were called American cockroaches, but perhaps it simply makes sense to label as American anything that is larger than normal. I remember the veranda upstairs that looked across at our neighbor's Professor Awachi's compound. My brothers and I played paper people there, and when I was a teenager, I skulked there and spied on the older boy on whom I had a crush. Nothing came of it. When my parents retired from the university 10 years ago and moved out of the house, I went through a mourning that even now still feels raw. I visited the house a few years ago and I felt a terrible sense of loss because the new owners, the new occupants, had scraped the yard of all of its vegetation. It looked like a prison yard and felt oddly like a violation of my memory. But my mourning of that house is less about an actual house than about what it represented. Home for my close-knit family, my parents, and their 6 children. It was in that house that I began to form a sense of self, and it was in that house that I first began to read. Reading was the abiding love of my childhood. I remember books as physical things, some with covers torn off, spines cracked, others with the stiff and transparent plastic cover from the library. I remember books as mood and place. Reading curled up in bed during heavy rains, reading in the room downstairs that, after my older sisters left home, became the family dumping ground. The sunlight alarmingly bright through the large windows. Reading as I ate at the dining table, the book propped against the tall flask that was filled with hot water for tea. I remember books as consolation, and I remember books as absolute luminous pleasure. I was an early reader and read mostly British children's books. Enid Blyton was a favorite. And because of her books, I came to long for certain things: ginger beer, the circus, picnics. I was also an early writer, and the first stories I wrote were about white people in England who ate apples and talked about the weather, because that was what the characters in the books I read did. Even though I could not understand for the life of me what people actually said when they talked about the weather. In my world, the sun was always out, except for when it rained, and then the sun was out again. But I was a child, and like all children, I was vulnerable in the face of a story. And because I had not seen myself reflected in books, I did not think that people like me could be in books. My experience was not unique. It is, in fact, devastatingly ordinary. I have heard similar stories from people who grew up in Kenya and Sri Lanka and Jamaica and India. To be brought up educated in a post-colonial developing country is to encounter books as wonderful and fascinating and enjoyable, but fundamentally foreign. When did my view of literature expand? When did I learn that my stories were worthy of literature? When I discovered other kinds of writing as an older child. Kamara Lai's novel, L'Enfant Noir, translated into English as The Dark Child or The African Child, remains one of the most beautiful books I have ever read in its nostalgia and elegy and beauty about a boy growing up in Guinea. Chinua Achebe's Arrow of God was a glorious discovery. Here was a book that was delicious page by page, but also a kind of gesture of returned pride. It was a book that said, "Don't you dare believe other people's story of you." I loved Flora Mwapa's books about Igbo women, the way they felt both familiar and not. There was a wonderful young adult African series called The Pace Setters, dramas and romances and thrillers, and in reading them, I discovered the rest of Africa. One, for example, was called Meet Me in Conakry, and for a long time, that West African capital held a certain romance for me because of that book. On the university campus, books drifted in and out of homes, borrowed and returned, creased and torn, passed around. I read everything, except for fantasy. The world seemed to me so unknown and unknowable that it felt like an evasion to have to inhabit imaginary worlds while the mysteries of our own world, of human emotion and motivation, were yet to be deciphered. So I just didn't do Lord of the Rings. Sorry. I read every Mills and Boone romance that came my way. I read Albert Speer's Inside the Third Reich at the age of 10. I read Sidney Sheldon and Robert Ludlum. I read Anna Karenina and Water Babies and The Loss of El Dorado. And like many teenagers in Anglophone West Africa, I read every single book by a writer called James Hadley Chase, whose crime novels had such choice titles as Like a Hole in the Head. All of his books were set in America and had their own particular hard-boiled language. I was deflated to learn years later that nobody in America had ever heard of James Hadley Chase. I had not, at the time, been indoctrinated into the esteemed cult of literary snobbery. I did not yet know of that spurious distinction between commercial and literary fiction. For me, the distinction was merely books that moved me and books that did not. I read, too, about the Catholic Church. My father had books about the church, and on days when there was nothing else to read, I would dust them off and read them. Because I grew up in Igbo land, and the majority of people in my world were Igbo, ethnic tribalism was not a specter on campus, as no doubt it would have been had I grown up on a campus in one of Nigeria's more cosmopolitan centers. What we had was religious tribalism. There was a Catholic-Protestant divide on campus, itself a colonial carryover, a legacy of competing missionaries, the Irish Catholics and the British Anglicans, who divided as they converted. My father's family, for example, having become Roman Catholic in the 1920s, were discouraged from attending the weddings of their Anglican relatives. The religious tribalism on campus was largely mild. And for us children, it consisted of arguments in the playground about which church was better. I was nearly always the spokesperson for the Catholic side. Because I had read big books and I could use big words that the other children did not understand. Of course, they didn't know that I hardly understood those words myself. Transubstantiation, magisterium, infallibility. And then, that word that I loved upon discovering it, apologist. I considered myself, at the age of 12, a proud Catholic apologist. I read books to find out how to argue the Catholic case for the Blessed Virgin and for priests being celibate and for the Bible not being the all and all. It had to be scripture and tradition, not just scripture. And today I can still quote the bits of scripture that back up that very Catholic sacrament of the anointing of the sick. I could quote it for you if you'd like. Is anyone sick among you? Let him bring in the priest of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick man, and the Lord shall raise him up. And if he be in sins, they shall be forgiven him. My family's Catholicism was moderate but conservative. The African permutation of Roman Catholicism with its subtle and not so subtle disparagement of pre-Christian Africa. To be baptized, you had to choose an English name because English was Christian and African languages were not. We went to Mass every Sunday. In case you're wondering, I did have an English name which I discarded as soon as I could. We went to Mass every Sunday, all dressed up. And after Mass, we took a drive to town to buy snacks and newspapers. Mass fascinated me. The drama, the colors, the rituals. At Easter, I cried during Paschal Mass at night when people lit candles and then raised them up in the dark, and it felt like a sea of stars. I knew the words the priest said, and I would sometimes repeat them under my breath. Sometimes I even wanted to be a priest. Not a nun, which seemed to me a subservient, monochromatic role, devoid of power and drama and that halo of invincibility that seemed to come naturally with priesthood. I was fascinated by faith, by the idea of what people believe and what it can make them do. And my first novel, Purple Hibiscus, would be about this, among other things. I see now how similar fiction and faith are, even how intertwined. Faith is a form of fiction, and fiction requires faith. Both have no need for proof. I asked questions about Catholicism, about doctrine, about religion, about God. At first, my questions were asked of adults in my family, in catechism class, and at confession, all in the service of defending Catholicism. But soon, as a young teenager, my questions became more about understanding, about doctrine that seemed to me to contradict the idea of a just and loving God. This kind of questioning made adults uncomfortable, and often was met with various strategies of silencing. When I did get answers, I found many of them unsatisfactory, too simplistic, or dissembling, or quite simply, nonsensical. And I did not understand the stubborn refusal on the parts of adults to admit to ignorance or incompleteness on matters of faith. I began then to recognize in myself a strain of resistance, a distrust of what seemed too easy or too glib. And I think this way of looking at the world has deeply informed my writing. On campus, all the Catholic children went to catechism classes 3 times a week until such a time as they took the examination for First Holy Communion. First Holy Communion was very exciting. Your mother took you to the market to buy white fabric for a dress and white lace for a veil, and then to the tailor to make the dress, and you barely slept at night because you were delighted and afraid of finally having that small white circle of bread in your mouth, the host, as it was called, and you kept in mind all the stories you had been told, especially the one about a child who stole one host and took it home, only for the room in their house to suddenly become filled with blood. I'm not sure how many here are Catholic, but I think that there are various versions of this sort of myth. I thought the host would melt like ice on my tongue. And when finally I received communion, its dry, papery texture was a disappointment to me. But this story is really about dogs and memory. So to prepare for First Holy Communion, I went to catechism because my brother Oke had already received his First Holy Communion, and my brother Kene was not yet old enough for catechism, so I went alone. The church was a 20-minute walk from home, so I would set off in the afternoon wearing a day dress, rubber slippers, and the requisite scarf. For every visit to church, girls and women wore scarves. But each catechism day filled me with trepidation because I would have to walk past the Odokara's house, and they had dogs that lay sprawled in front of their house, fierce dogs that were known to be poorly trained, were known to chase and bite. And so one afternoon I was walking past, terrified, my face resolutely turned away from their house, but I heard the dogs growl once and then again, and I sensed, rather than saw, one of the dogs fly up. And my body suddenly became light as I ran. This is a clear memory I have, running down the street, pursued by a dog. I did not know I was screaming as I ran until I dashed into our compound, and my mother, who had just driven in, was standing by her car, and she said, "Is that why you're screaming and running down the street, just because of a dog?" I thought she should have been more sympathetic. Actually, she said it in Igbo, which sounded even less sympathetic. Sympathy came, however, in her putting me in the car and taking me to the church. When I recounted this story years later, having been asked why I was afraid of dogs, my brother Oke told me that my scarf had flown off my head as I ran, and that he went back later and picked it up from the street and brought it home for me. I did not remember this at all, but I have added that detail to my memory of that day, and I have come to think of memory as a kind of collective sculpture. When I read years later about James Joyce's fear of dogs, having himself been pursued by one as a child, I felt strangely comforted. I was a child with many questions, and I was educated in a system in which questioning was not necessarily rewarded. In secondary school, I always got straight A's in all my subjects, which would have pleased any parent, but each last day of term, my stomach would tighten with anxiety because my teachers often wrote comments about what they termed my lack of respect. And these comments always got me in trouble with my parents. I still have not forgiven those teachers. Lack of respect was really my curiosity, my asking questions, my taking delight in intellectual argument, my refusal to accept easy answers, my reluctance to perform a certain kind of exaggerated deference. My teachers, I felt, should not have punished me for this. I suspect that this particular resentment, the sense of self-righteous unfairness that I feel, has propelled some of my writing. I do see now, looking back, that I could very well have been a bit of an annoying child. And yet, I wish the adults who had authority over me had known how to guide my questioning and how to encourage my curiosity. I did have some wonderful teachers who did that, but there were exceptions to the rule. I was drawn early on to language and to languages. I grew up with both Igbo. Actually, sorry, I have to go back a bit and tell you about two wonderful teachers I had. There was the gentle, wonderful Mrs. Carlo in grade 5A, who let me write plays and produce them with my classmates, who encouraged my writing and my reading. "You feel things too strongly," she said to me once, and there was a wistful sort of sadness in her eyes, as though she knew that this would be both blessing and curse, that it would infuse my writing, but that also it would lead to that curse of the creative depression. There was Mrs. Chukwudebelu, a wonderful English teacher in secondary school who encouraged my love of English. She read my essays closely, encouraging and guiding me. So great was her faith in me that she would ask a question in class, a few people would get it wrong, and then she would invariably turn to me and say, "Adichie, tell them." Her confidence in me made me want to do and be better, but I also lived in secret terror, imagining the day when I would not, in fact, know the correct answer. I was drawn early on to language and to languages. I grew up with both Igbo and English as my first languages, but we were not allowed to speak Igbo in school. It was called, with a derogatory tone, speaking in the vernacular. Even the word vernacular was wrapped in shame. I look back now at the absurdity of it, and also the great sadness of it. How colonialism's most insidious legacy is its ability to make you denigrate that which is yours. My Nigerian education was exclusively in English. It was considered terribly uncool to take Igbo as a subject, but I did, up until the senior secondary school level, and I got the highest A grade. I enjoyed it, learning the morphology of the language I spoke, although written Igbo was a different version of what I spoke at home. But Igbo, for me, remains the language of family and informality. I cannot make a philosophical argument in Igbo because my education did not give me the tools, and I regret this. But it was important to me from the beginning to show in my writing this world of two languages, where characters spoke two languages, as did many of the people I grew up with, sometimes in the same sentence. Editors, American editors often tried to get me to take out the Igbo bits in my fiction, or to tone it down, or to over-explain it. But I always chose not to. Trying to show the texture of my world was important to me and important to the integrity of my fiction. And perhaps I wanted also to make a political and emotional claim, but above all else, a truthful claim, that both languages belong to me, that both languages are fully and equally mine. My father speaks Igbo beautifully, and he is a radiant storyteller. He told stories mostly of his childhood so often through the years that I came to know the stories myself, and I would sometimes remind him of a detail that he had omitted from a previous version. My grandfather, his father, who died in Biafra during the war and whom I never knew, came startlingly alive through my father's storytelling. I deeply enjoyed spending time with my family, my parents, my siblings, listening to my father bring up the past. He spoke always in Igbo, except for when he had to explain a particularly complex proverb, which was above the level of the anglicized Igbo that we children spoke. I loved the anecdotes, the proverbs, the wit, the humor, and I would soak them all up, absorb them, store them. And as I became older, I began to feel a sense of pride about the culture from which these stories came. Pride that I came from a wise and humorous and enterprising and kind people. But the best place to listen to spoken Igbo was in my ancestral hometown, Aba, the village. Like most Igbo families, we had two homes, one in the town where we lived, on campus, and where my parents walked, and the other home, the more permanent home, in my father's ancestral hometown. It was to this home that we journeyed at Christmas, at Easter, on some weekends, or for short stays when we children were on holiday. Our house was an old, rambling two-story building enclosed by cement walls, a red gate, a sandy yard that was particularly good for playing. Orange trees, a little orchard of banana trees in the back. Once my mother attempted the planting of flowers in our yard, but some stray goats made their way into our compound when the gate man neglected to close the gates, and those resourceful animals saw in the red and yellow flowers a perfectly colorful feast. And so that was the end of the flowers in the village. Pythons were sacred in my part of Igbo land. My sister told me a story of a python found curled in my grandmother's outhouse years before I was born. My sister was terrified, but my grandmother merely walked into the bathroom and spoke gently to the python, asking it to please leave so as not to scare the children. The python then uncurled itself and slid away. There were many other stories I heard in the village about life in the village, of people who killed you with obu, native medicine, of people who turned into animals, of people whose bodies were hard as metal and impervious to weapons, of people who went to secret nightly meetings at the bottom of the sea. When I discovered years later a genre of writing called magical realism, I felt immediately suspicious because I knew intimately this was a world where magical was not considered magical at all, but merely ordinary, merely a part of life. At Christmas in the village, the big masquerades appeared and children were filled with excitement at going to see them. But girls, I was told, could not see the most exciting masquerades. Why? I asked. Well, because they're girls. The unfairness of this stayed with me, and I began early to question and argue about the need to discard the parts of Igbo culture that diminished the humanity of women. And that arguing, questioning process remains ongoing. Still, today, to be back in my ancestral hometown is to feel a sense of an almost atavistic belonging. It is quite simply home. It is where my fierce great-grandmother, in family law, supposed to be her reincarnation, lived. My great-grandmother is my feminist icon. She was known to be a troublemaker, which is the best compliment a woman can receive. My ancestral hometown is where I want to be buried. And I like to think that this rootedness, this metaphysical rootedness to a physical place, acts as a springboard for me and enables me ultimately to feel comfortable in any part of the world. I wrote my first book at the age of 8. It was called Down Macintosh Lane. And of course, it had characters with blue eyes. They were called Anne and Kathy, and they had a dog called Socks. At the age of 10, I had to have an appendectomy, and I was taken to the University of Nigeria Teaching Hospital in Enugu. And I stayed away from school for more than a week after the surgery. I was thrilled by this because it meant time to do nothing but write. What do you want me to bring for you? My sister EJ asked me right after the surgery. And I was supposed to ask for all the things I might not ordinarily get without the benefit of being sick. Sweets, biscuits, chocolate. But I asked for exercise books, as many as she could bring. And I should say that exercise books means notebooks. Because I realize I'm talking to an American audience. This has nothing to do with actually exercise, and it's notebooks. But for us who grew up in formerly colonized countries, we say things like exercise book. But I asked for exercise books, as many as she could bring, because I intended to fill them up with writing. I wrote on my hospital bed, and there was an element of subversion in that writing, the idea that I was doing this thing that was my first love, instead of the sensible thing, which was schoolwork. And later, when I was briefly in medical school, which I applied for because anyone who does well in school was expected to become a doctor, I would write story sketches at the back of my notebooks during biology class, and I felt then, too, that element of subversion. My family was supportive of my writing, but it was understood and unspoken that this was not a potential career. It was something you did in addition to your career. I was in the Young Writers Club at school, for example, and this was encouraged, but grades in my subjects came first before the Young Writers Club. At the age of 13, I sent off two poems I had written to a magazine called Prime People. Now, Prime People did not publish poetry. It was a gossipy cultural weekly. But my sisters read it, and so it was always in our home. The editor must have been so startled by those poems and by my cover letter stating how old I was, that the poems were promptly published in the next edition. That was my very first publication. At the age of 17, I wrote a play about Biafra and sent it off to a reputable publisher near Lagos, and it was accepted for publication. And then there was a poetry collection that I grandly called My Anthology of 100 Poems. Now, of course, I hope that nobody ever gets to see any of those atrocious poems. My mother asked her secretary, a tall, warm, ambitious man called John, to type up the poems and to have them bound in a manuscript. John, my mother later told me, did not mind at all that he had to type this teenage poetry. She knew this because he read them aloud as he typed. And at the end, he told my mother, with delight, Let's wait and see what this child will become. Thank you.
So the first question I have for you is, you've said that fiction is more honest than nonfiction. Can you explain this belief?
I did. So one of the perils of being a public figure is people can dig out something you said, you know, when you were drunk 15 years ago. And then you're not really allowed to change your mind because then it sort of seems like you're... But I do know, I do stand by that. And what I mean, I do. This one I stand by. And it's that I just think that as a writer, and I do both, I write fiction, I write nonfiction. And in writing fiction, I find myself in a space of a kind of radical honesty because I'm not thinking about protecting anybody. When I write nonfiction, if I'm writing memoir, I'm thinking about protecting myself. I'm thinking about protecting the people I love. There's so many things I cannot write about now because the people who are the subjects are alive and I love them. And I don't want to write about those things. I suppose I could write about them in fiction because then it really wouldn't be about those people that I love. It would be about character. And so in that sense, I think that as... you know, as a practitioner, I just trust fiction more in general than I do nonfiction and memoir. So that's kind of, yeah, that's.
Keeping in mind the current state of Nigeria, what would your advice be to young Nigerians who have completed their education in the U.S. and have hopes of moving back to Nigeria? That seems very specific.
Where are you? Hello.
They're waving over there.
Go back. Yeah, you can try. Nigeria is, you know, wonderfully complicated place. So now that I live in both places, Nigeria is also a place of opportunity. But most of all, it's a place that needs young people. It's a place that needs new ideas, and so there is space for you. And one of the privileges, I think, of people like you who've been educated outside Nigeria is that, and this in some ways I think is actually unfair, is that there's an assumption that if you have a foreign degree, you're somehow, you have certain abilities, which is not necessarily true. We know that, right? But it really means then that you go back to Nigeria with a certain level of privilege and also responsibility, of course. So I would say yes, but have a plan, right? Have a plan. Have a plan about how you're going to pay your rent. Or find an uncle to live with.
What do you hope
I love that laugh.
For the legacy of your writing?
I don't know. I don't actually think about this. This whole idea of thinking about legacy, I find this when I read biographies of male writers. So I don't know. I'm serious though. So I don't know. So you sort of read these biographies and you realize that, you know, this male writer has barely written two books and clearly he becomes obsessed with his legacy, right? And I'm thinking, really? So I'm not sure if it's something about female socialization, that we're not socialized to think about our legacies, or maybe that women are just socialized to have a quiet confidence where we kind of feel like, yeah, it'll be fine. It'll, you know, the legacy will be fine. So I don't really think about it, honestly. I feel very grateful to be read, and, you know, that my work matters to people means a lot to me, deeply means a lot to me. You know, I think there's a sense in which sometimes it's sophisticated to pretend that you're just writing and if people care or not. But I care. So it makes me really happy. But I don't consciously think about my legacy, at least not yet.
Where did Americana begin for you? Was it a place, a character, or an image, or something else?
I don't know. I'm going to invent an answer now because I really... I think it became as... I think I had... So when I was walking on Half of a Yellow Sun, which was such an emotional, just deeply emotional experience for me because it was a process of mining the pain of my family, and I had done so much research, and I remember in a vague sort of way thinking that I had cried so much in the process of writing Half of a Yellow Sun, and I remember thinking, I want to laugh when I write my next book. And so maybe that's where Americana came from. It first started as a desire for laughter. And I wanted to write about America. I felt that I had lived here long enough, and I was constantly making notes about the strangenesses of America. And also I had discovered race, and I felt like I felt that I hadn't seen race, and I should be particular, I hadn't seen blackness in America written about in fiction in a way that I wanted to see, and in some ways I think I then wanted to do that. So it was all of those things, wanting to write about blackness in America, discovering blackness, wanting to laugh, wanting to write a book that was nothing like Half of a Yellow Sun.
We have just time for one more question. You talked tonight about faith and fiction. Do you see writing as something spiritual?
I do, yes. Yes. I think of my writing as a gift. And so I think that I can take ownership of making the decision to use the gift and to work hard at it. But the gift itself is not something I think I didn't make it. I think that it's a gift. And the process of using that gift can very often feel bigger than myself. One of the things that gives me the greatest joy when my writing is going well is that I feel transported and that my characters take on a life of their own, which continues to be a difficult thing to explain to people who don't create, because they think you're crazy when you say that the character did something you didn't plan, but it does happen. And that for me is it's spiritual. Yes, I do think, I think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Chimamanda Adichie speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in March 2019 as part of the Everybody Reads program. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.